Hello and welcome to The Learning College, put on by Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to resume with Merchants of Sin by Benjamin Garland. You can find that at merchantsofsin.com, but hyphenated, merchants-of-sin.com. Buy it through, I think, Lulu and Amazon there. This is a book about Jews purveying vice in the United States and a lot of the court decisions that legalized that. So we went from a society that was interested in suppressing vice in the late 1800s and early 1900s to one that was basically open to redefining pornography as free speech, allowing whatever Jews want pretty much to spread wherever they wanted it, to morally unstring society while real free speech increasingly came under assault. Last time we did the introduction in the first two chapters. Today we're going to do chapters 3 and 4, page 28 up through 57. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and eventually at alexlinder.com. So let's dig into it. Again, this is Merchants of Sin by Benjamin Garland, 2017. Chapter 3, last time we heard about comic books, and a lot of Jews were in pornography and spread into comic books, and it became so violent that Congress actually held hearings on comic books in the 1950s. Isn't that amazing? There are even some thrill killers in Brooklyn, some disturbed homo Jews who went out and duplicated what they read in one of the comic books we heard about last time. So this is our second session. Chapter 3, Roth versus United States. Epigraph. If Roth were not the opportunistic, irascible, and sometimes megalomaniacal idealist he was, the early 1960s advances in freedom of expression would not have happened when they did. So said J. Gertzman, G-E-R-T-Z-M-A-N. Samuel Roth, Hebrew name Mishilim, was born in 1894 in a shtetl in the Eastern European region between Austria and Poland, then known as Galicia, noted for some of the scummiest Jews on earth, Galicia. His family emigrated to New York in 1904 when he was about 10 years old. Roth worked at some odds and ends jobs, and then he began writing poetry and resolved to go into publishing, where he would continually push the boundaries of what was considered acceptable throughout his entire career, ultimately getting himself arrested no less than 8 times and serving a total of 9 years of his adult life in prison. Having his offices raided at least once a year from 1927 to 1931, Roth was caught and charged for distributing a myriad of banned and obscene materials, such as the infamous Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence, which is discussed in Part 4, and portions of Ulysses by James Joyce, which is discussed in Part 1. Both were unauthorized. The latter especially was seen by his peers as a serious breach of ethics, resulting in his excommunication from literary circles following a letter of protest signed by 167 writers and intellectuals, such as Ernest Hemingway and Albert Einstein. So he's pirate copying works of art with some obscenity in them, enough to piss off not just the courts and the police, but his own contemporaries. Roth was a very colorful figure, assuming many roles in his life. Smut king, serious intellectual, family man, literary pariah, free speech martyr, and even for a time, self-hating Jew. In a bizarre episode in 1934, after a series of events which suddenly, blindingly, those are quotes, suddenly, blindingly led him to the realization that, quote, all the evils of his life had been, quote, perpetrated by Jews, Roth wrote and published the startling book, Jews Must Live, in which he confirmed many of the traditional anti-Jewish claims. And that is well worth reading, Jews Must Live. Roth writes of how he had shed his innate cognitive dissonance regarding the true nature of his tribe after losing his business to a conspiracy of Jew, quote, vultures and shysters, deciding then to be the first Jew to, quote, to arise and tell the truth about them. I am a Jew who has been brought to the point where he so loathes his people that he thinks in terms of their destruction, he wrote. While Roth never shared, quote, the Jewish contempt for the Goyim, which he explained is part and parcel of all Jewish psychology, he claimed he had not written the book to curry favor with the Gentile, but rather to tell the truth as he saw it, for cathartic purposes, as something of an organic necessity. In it, he wrote that Jews had made a, quote, hideous swamp of Western civilization, that anti-Semitism is a, quote, primal instinct of mankind, which preserves the race against total destruction, and that the Jews have deserved all of their pogroms and persecutions. Asterisk, which reads, Samuel Roth, Jews must live, colon, an account of the persecution of the world by Israel on all frontiers of civilization. 1934, page 177-78, footnote, the next time you read about a particularly bloody pogrom and pause to wonder how Christians, dedicated to a religion of mercy, can exercise so much brutality against the Jews, remember that the Jew wheedles all the mercy out of his neighbors in the ordinary course of business. He lies and cheats until he is caught. When caught, instead of accepting punishment, he moans and tears his hair, invokes the sores of ancestors in their graves and living relations at the point of death in hospitals, until the wrong Gentile, nauseated, lets him go. Then, thumbing his nose at the Gentile behind his back, the Jew goes about his business the same way, lying and cheating now doubly so, to make up for lost time. A pogrom is usually the climax of years of such relentless goading. Do you wonder that when the final reckoning time comes, the Gentile is absolutely merciless? Quote, our major vice of old, as of today, he wrote, is parasitism. We are a people of vultures, living on the labor and the good nature of the rest of the world. Jews, he explained, are firmly convinced that they will eventually inherit the earth, and they consider themselves its natural masters. All these are quotes. Quote, it was practically a moral obligation on the part of every conscientious Jew to fool and cheat the Goy wherever and whenever possible. Leolam Tikka, quote, always take, is the way and the motto of the Jew, according to Roth. Leolam Tikkah, always take. Quote, when the Goy had been cheated, business was good, he wrote. When the Jew had come out even, business was very bad indeed. Leolam Tikkah. Little Jews, he continued, are taught in Hebrew school that they are the salt of the earth, and that everything in it belongs to them, that as a racial Jew, apart from all the other races, he is waging an old war against his neighbors, and that to do manual labor for one's livelihood is the very worst state the young Jew can fall to, something to make him really ashamed and humiliated. He asserted that the Jews had done nothing but stab America, the most patient of the Western nations, in the back. Quote, there is blood in the eye of Uncle Sam as he looks across the ringside at the pudgy, smiling Uncle Moses. It is my honest belief, he wrote, that nothing the Jew does in America is essential to its welfare. On the contrary, a great deal of what the American Jew does is subversive of America's best interests, as we see them trying to goad us into war, as I read this to you in 2017, war against Iran has done nothing to us. Casting our eyes across to page 31, we find a full page ad for Jews Must Live by Samuel Roth, all these quotes have been from, an account of the persecution of the world by Israel on all of the frontiers of civilization. And this is coming, you know, within a decade, let's say, or 15 years of Henry Ford's The International Jew, the world's foremost problem. And so the Golden Hind Press out of New York, illustrated by John Conrad, Samuel Roth's Jews Must Live, an account of the persecution of the world by Israel on all the frontiers of civilization. This almost sounds like a Jew echoing what Henry Ford's researchers had dug up. Flipping to 32. Ironically, Roth was himself a supreme example of a subversive Jew, one who did incalculable damage through his relentless insistence on distributing obscene and pornographic materials. This seeming paradox is likely explained by the fact that Roth actually believed that he was doing the right thing, fighting against censorship, a sort of freedom crusade, While being grilled by the Senate Subcommittee on Obscene and Pornographic Materials in 1955, see Part 2, on the ethics of involving his wife in his dirty business, he shouted, "The only thing I can tell you is that we were right." Judging by the transcript, where it can be read that the officials had to tell him to sit down, it had been a dramatic scene. There's a picture of Roth looking up with an open mouth and spectacles. Roth testifying before the 1955 Senate Subcommittee on Obscene and Pornographic Materials. Roth denounced Jews Must Live almost immediately after publishing, and it remained a stain on his reputation and an embarrassment that he was forced to carry around for the rest of his life. It also served to further alienate him from the heavily Jewish literary community, and as a result, he began publishing obscene, sensational, and pornographic material almost exclusively following 1934. He was again charged for this activity in 1935, for which he was acquitted, and then again in 1936, for which he received 3 years, serving until 1939, and yet again in 1942, for which he received 2 years probation. After a few more skirmishes with the law and postal authorities, Roth was finally indicted on 4 counts of obscenity, for which he was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment and a $5,000 fine in 1956. The charge stemmed from 2 of Roth's publications, the periodical Good Times and the hardbound journal American Aphrodite. The latter included a story in which a unicorn kneels down and, quote, laps up its own semen after having been masturbated by one of the characters. On appeal to the Second Circuit Court of New York, the decision was affirmed by all judges. One Jewish judge, however, while not dissenting because he felt it was not his place to do so as a judge in a lower court, wrote a powerful concurrence in which he implored the Supreme Court to finally weigh in on the matter of obscenity and set a new national precedent. The judge, Jerome Frank, who was heavily influenced by the writing and research of Morris Ernst and Alfred Kinsey and a Freud devotee, all of whom are discussed further in Part 5, made a very slick case for the liberalization of obscenity laws. Frank's concurring opinion, which hit the law world like an earthquake, highlighted many seeming contradictions and hypocrisies in the regulation of obscenity, of which a shrewd law expert can inevitably find many. Thanks largely to Frank's opinion, the Supreme Court was at long last ready to address the morass of obscenity law. The first case they decided was that of Butler v. Michigan in early 1957, in which they cemented the Ulysses decision as a national precedent. The Ulysses decision, as discussed in Part 1, we heard last session, altered the original American obscenity test, the Hicklin test, from one that judged a book by the effect it would have on those who were susceptible to a moral influence, i.e. children or perverts, kind of the weak-minded, to its effect on the average person, whatever that means, average in quotes. So the Ulysses decision altered it from before, if it's going to have any effects on the weak-minded or children or perverts, then it should be outlawed, to whatever effect it has on the average person is how you should judge it. Picture of Jerome Frank. The Jew Felix Frankfurter famously wrote in the court's decision, quote, "The state insists that, by thus quarantining the general reading public against books not too rugged for grown men and women, in order to shield juvenile innocence, surely this is to burn the house down to roast the pig." Butler was not terribly significant, though, as the Ulysses decision had already been standard in the lower courts for many years. What the obscenity law activists were really clamoring for was the question of constitutionality. Is obscenity protected by the First Amendment, which says the government shall make no law, quote, abridging the freedom of speech, or is it not? Roth's case, which came next, tackled the issue head on. The verdict, no. Obscenity is not protected by the First Amendment. 6-3, that was affirmed. Quote, "Implicit in the history of the First Amendment is the rejection of obscenity as utterly without redeeming social importance," the decision reads. And then there's a big picture of Felix Frankfurter. I believe he was the first Jew on the Supreme Court. Roth, after contacting the FBI and offering to go undercover in Mexico and infiltrate the leftist expatriate movement as an informant in a last-ditch effort to avoid his sentence, was imprisoned and served for the full 5 years. While the court had declared that obscenity was not protected by the First Amendment, the definition of what would be considered obscene had now been broadened considerably. Materials would now have to be, quote, utterly without redeeming social importance, and pass what became known as the Roth test, which was so ridiculously convoluted and sloppily worded it gave lawyers almost endless leeway. Quote, whether to the average person, applying contemporary community standards, the dominant theme of the material, taken as a whole, appeals to prurient interest. Who is the average person? How does one measure contemporary community standards? What exactly does taken as a whole mean? How much need not appeal to prurient interest in order for prurience not to be considered the dominant theme of a work? Whose prurient interest is in question? How much redeeming social importance does it take to save a work? Whose opinion do you go by? Etc., etc., ad infinitum. For this reason, Roth v. United States was, and still remains, by far the most significant decision in the history of American obscenity law. Roth v. United States, the most significant decision in the history of American obscenity law. While in prison, Roth wrote his final book, My Friend Yeshua. He had experienced vivid hallucinations throughout his entire life, beginning when he saw a, quote, beast rising out of a steam as a young child in the shtetl. Roth claimed that he had talked with Yeshua, Jesus, on at least four different occasions, and My Friend Yeshua was his attempt at reconciling Jews and Gentiles, which he saw as the only way to end anti-Semitism and their eternal conflict. If not I, who? Roth would say grandiosely. Quote, all differences between Jews and their persecutors must be abolished, Yeshua allegedly had told him during a vision. By the time Roth was released in 1961, what was now considered acceptable made what he had published look like Sesame Street, largely due to his case. Largely due to his case. So he got jailed for it, but it did in fact open it up, in practical terms, to obscenity. Paradoxically, the precedent set by the Roth decision would have dictated that the material in question in Roth's own case was indeed not legally obscene because it could have been shown to have redeeming social importance. But since Roth's defense was argued strictly on constitutional grounds, he was still convicted. Quote, I alone did not benefit from the decision in my case, he lamented in all caps. Emphasis his. Ultimately, he was satisfied with the outcome, though, now being able to see himself as a martyr for the greater good. Quote, however little I have accomplished for myself, I have won the greatest victory against book censorship in modern times, he wrote, his grandiosity again surfacing as he continued, quote, I am not complaining. It took only 10 years of my life to ease the laws of my country toward the tenderer organs of its literature. I said, let our books live. And now they live. In part 4, we will look at the watershed decisions from between the years 1959 and 1967, which were all directly influenced by Roth, before getting into the cultural conditions that created the environment in which these decisions were able to take place in parts 5, 6, and 7. That's chapter 3, and that was about Roth, and now chapter 4, Opening the Floodgates, page 38 up through 57, this will be. Chapter 4, Opening the Floodgates, epigraph. Under the Hicklin test, any obscenity in a work, no matter how slight, contaminated the whole. Under the Roth test, any slight redeeming trait purified it. So said Leo Pfeffer, P-F-E-F-F-E-R, means pepper in German. The first major publication to reap the benefits of the precedent set by the Roth decision, discussed last chapter in Part 3, was Howl, and other poems by the Jewish beat poet Allen Ginsberg, who was a pedophile. The Beats, or the Beat Generation, were a literary clique centered around Ginsberg. They were all criminals, degenerates, junkies, and mentally insane sexual deviants, and indeed reveled in those qualities and promoted them as the ideal way to be. In effect, they were the precursor to the broader counterculture movement, which would ultimately revolutionize America with, quote, sex, drugs, and rock and roll in the 1960s and 70s. See Part 5. Both of Ginsberg's parents were Russian-born Jews, and he had a very disturbed upbringing. His father was a socialist, and Ginsberg wrote of, quote, getting hard-ons while sleeping in bed with him, rubbing up against his leg, just pressing close and holding on to him. His mother was a die-hard communist who brought him and his siblings to communist summer camp, making Ginsberg a red diaper baby. All those camps were in New York, so they live around New York City, and they go to their summer camps out in the Poconos and the Catskills and the mountains around there. They'd have Jewish summer camps that were dedicated to ideology, and those are red diaper babies, the Jews born in the 30s of parents who had first come over, you know, from 1880 on. His mother eventually developed paranoid schizophrenia and suffered severe hallucinations, believing Ginsberg's father was trying to poison her, and once seeing Hitler's mustache in the sink. In her later years, she would wander around the house naked and believed that the government was beaming radio waves into her brain and reading her thoughts. Ginsberg eventually sanctioned a lobotomy on her in an attempt to alleviate her suffering and never forgave himself for this act. There's a big picture of him. He's a very hairy, typically Jew-looking Jew. Ginsberg himself was a lifelong homosexual and sexual predator who got off on convincing straight men to sleep with him, and was also a member and vocal supporter of the pederasty advocate group, the North American Man-Boy Love Association, or NAMBLA. Howl, written in 1956, was a reflection of Ginsberg's deranged Jewish mind, with its innumerable references to cocks, cunts, semen, and those who let themselves be fucked in the ass by saintly motorcyclists. Publishing it was a risky endeavor at the time, given the existing obscenity laws. The avant-garde bookstore owner, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, decided to take the risk after receiving assurance from the heavily Jewish American Civil Liberties Union that they would defend the publication were it to run into trouble. Which I almost hope it does, Ginsberg wrote to his father. I am almost ready to tackle the U.S. government out of sheer self-delight. Trouble it soon found. Ferlinghetti was raided on June 3, 1957, I believe his bookstore's in North San Francisco. Just 3 weeks before the Roth decision, Ferlinghetti was raided in 57, arrested and charged with obscenity. One of the shrewdest and most famous Jewish lawyers in the country, Jake Ehrlich, whom the popular TV character Perry Mason was based on, took the lead in the case. Naturally, Ehrlich and his team structured their defense on the Roth decision, which had changed the definition of obscenity to whether the work, to whether or not a work overall had, quote, redeeming social and literary value. This didn't leave the prosecutor with much to work with. He would somehow have to prove that the entire work was meaningless, an almost impossible task. The defense, on the other hand, only had to track down a few of the untold thousands of literary authorities who could be shown to have credentials to claim that the work was of great merit. Of this, they brought nine. The presiding judge, Clayton Horn, despite being a devout Christian who had notoriously sentenced a shoplifter to a viewing of the Charlton Heston movie, The Ten Commandments, followed a strict reading of Roth and reversed the charge and found Howl not obscene. There's a big picture of Jake Ehrlich, Jew, defending this. Aside from further liberalizing obscenity law, the attempted suppression of Howl catapulted Ginsberg, the Beats, and their works to national fame with the extensive media coverage. Howl sold tens of thousands of copies before the trial was even concluded. And Ginsberg and the Beats were profiled by such widely read outlets as Life, Time, and the San Francisco Chronicle. Emboldened by the Roth and Howell decisions, Jewish publisher Barney Rosset, R-O-S-S-E-T, decided he would challenge obscenity laws directly. Rosset, born in Chicago in 1922, was a radical leftist even in his youth, publishing his first newspaper, The Sommunist, that is, socialist/communist, while still in high school. He was under surveillance by the government for his radicalism and suspected, quote, disaffection, beginning in 1943. Upon returning from World War II, where he served mainly as a photographer, Rosset joined the Communist Party in Chicago for a time, and then in 1948 produced the documentary, quote, Strange Victory, in which he attacked America as racist, like the Nazis. We took Hitler home with us, specifically in terms of racial problems in this country, he asserted. And a big graphic of Strange Victory. World premiere tomorrow. Powerful, persuasive, pulls no punches. The most daring and provocative story of prejudice ever shown on the screen. Told by Alfred Drake and Muriel Smith. Directed by Leo Hurwitz. Produced by Barney L. Rosset, Jr. Caption from Garland. America fought to save the Jews from Hitler, only to have many of them turn around and stab her in the back. So they're going to say, you're just like Hitler. They're going to use, well, you were willing to defeat Hitler and agree with us that he was bad in resisting our communism. So now we'll doubly punish you for that by saying that your whole society is Hitlerian in its racism and will destroy and unmake you on that basis you've agreed to. After receiving a hefty inheritance from his father, who was a wealthy Jewish banker, Rosset purchased the publishing company Grove Press in 1951, where he employed Jews almost exclusively, and would continue promoting his radical leftist agenda, becoming the foremost publisher of counterculture materials throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Being a far-left Jew, Rosset was virulently anti-white and pro-black. He published radical black authors such as Malcolm X and Amiri Baraka, who wrote outrageous anti-white vitriol such as, quote, rape the white girls, rape their fathers, cut the mothers' throats, and, quote, you can't steal nothing from a white man. He's already stole it. He owes you anything you want, even his life. Ideas common to Black Lives Matters, you know, 60, 70 years later. Rosset was a pervert to boot. He was admittedly obsessed with pornographic materials his entire life. As such, he was naturally against all forms of censorship. He compared censorship to anti-miscegenation attitudes. Quote, the fear that your daughter would sleep with a black man and the fear that your daughter would read that book. Threat quote. And fought vehemently for dissolution of those two taboos, apparently viewing a society where everyone's daughter could screw blacks and read pornographic books without consequence as an ideal utopia to strive for. And there was a asterisk up above that I skipped, but I'll read that now. Lauren Glass, Counterculture, Colophone, Grove Press, The Evergreen Review, and the Incorporation of the Avant-Garde. So that's a book by Lauren Glass, Counterculture, Colophone, Grove Press, The Evergreen Review, and the Incorporation of the Avant-Garde, 2013, page 1415. Quote, most of the key players at Grove were New York Jews. Fred Jordan, Rosset's right-hand man throughout the 60s, was a Holocaust survivor. As the company expanded, Rosset hired more New York Jews, including Maury Goldfisher, Nat Sobel, Herman Graf, Myron Shapiro, who ran the book club, Jules Geller, who ran the educational division, and Harry Braverman, who was a prominent editor and jack-of-all-trades at the company on and off throughout the 1960s. All these men came from the traditions of left-wing Jewish activism and cultural entrepreneurship, with many having close ties to labor groups, such as the Socialist Workers' Party. So this Jew from Chicago who has a rich Jewish banker father, and then he buys Grove Press and he hires all these New York left-wing Jews to run it. And back to the main text. Rosset was an unhinged, effeminate man, driven by his impulses. A military intelligence report described him as one who, quote, totally lacks sound judgment. He is incapable of appraising people, it reads. All of his impressions and judgments are based upon emotional reactions. This assessment was agreed upon by all of Rossett's associates who were contacted by Grove Press chronicler Lauren Glass, who we just heard from in that asterisk. And then there's a big picture, obscene, a portrait of Barney Rossett and Grove Press, and a picture of him, kind of a scrawny Jew smoking a cigarette with a big grin. These impulses drove him into taking the risk that no other of his ideological kin were willing to take. He published two of the most infamous banned books, Lady Chatterley's Lover by British author D.H. Lawrence and Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller, back-to-back, both of those goy authors. Lady Chatterley's Lover, the milder of the two, came first against the wishes of the Lawrence estate, specifically to pave the way for Tropic of Cancer. Quote, Chatterley really didn't give a damn too much of a damn about. Chatterley, he really didn't give too much of a damn about, says one of Rossett's colleagues in a 2007 documentary about him, Obscene. He didn't really think that was a wonderful book, but he was convinced that he needed a book of that stature in order to prepare the Tropic of Cancer case. It follows that Rossett would not appreciate Lady Chatterley's Lover as Lawrence's anti-modernity, anti-egalitarian political and philosophical views were diametrically at odds with Rossett's extreme leftism, but nevertheless it had some lesbian stuff in it, which is why he was publishing it. Lawrence, though friendly with many Jews, was also somewhat of an anti-Semite, at least by today's standards. He blamed the Jews for modern decadence and would often berate and criticize them. In a letter to one, quote, very bossy and overbearing Jew, according to Lawrence biographer Jeffrey Myers, quote, he stated that the Jews were elitist and smug. To another, Waldo Frank, he wrote that, quote, they were a cringing race, for their pride as the chosen people both provoked and compensated for their persecution. On another occasion, Lawrence wrote, in agreement with Edward Gibbon, paraphrasing what Gibbon wrote in his History of the Roman Empire, that, quote, the Jews are the great haters of the human race and the great antisocial principle. According to Lawrence, quote, humanity hated the Jews because of their conceited, self-worshipping religion, which he personally found to be, quote, abominable. Though Lady Chatterley's Lover is indeed a bit explicit, especially for its time, for his part, Lawrence was against outright pornography. In his essay, Obscenity and Pornography, he wrote, quote, but even I would censor genuine pornography rigorously. It would not be very difficult. Quote, about Lady C, he later wrote to Aldous Huxley, author of the prophetic Brave New World, you mustn't think I advocate perpetual sex in and out of season. Nothing nauseates me more than perpetual sex in and out of season. God forbid that I should be taken as urging loose sex activity. It would then seem that Lawrence, who died in 1930, would have been displeased to see how the Jews later used his work as a means of clearing the path for, quote, genuine pornography and broader sexual liberation. Henry Miller, on the other hand, was Rossett's hero. He just had a contempt for this country that I shared, Rossett explains in Obscene. I said, well, we'll publish Lady Chatterley's Lover first, and when we win that battle, we will then do Tropic of Cancer. I didn't do that to save humanity. I did it to save Tropic of Cancer. Rossett's plan paid off in spades. Lady Chatterley's Lover was cleared and became Grove Press's most successful publication, selling almost 2 million copies by 1960. This earned them enough money to fund future court battles and secured their reputation as the premier fighters in the front lines of the battle over obscenity. Following this victory, Rossett and Grove Press prepared to publish Tropic of Cancer, which had first been published by their European counterpart, Obelisk. Founded in France by a Jewish expatriate from England, Jack Kahane, or Kahane, K-A-H-A-N-E, Obelisk, founded in France by a Jew from England, Obelisk specialized in publishing books that were banned in English-speaking countries. Those who traveled through France could then easily purchase them. Following his death, Kahane's son, Maurice Giordias, G-I-O-R-D-I-A-S, took over Obelisk and changed its name to Olympia in 1953. Giordias, like his father before him, delighted in subverting European mores with obscenity. Quote, "It was great fun," he recalled in a memoir. The Anglo-Saxon world was being attacked, invaded, infiltrated, outflanked, and conquered by this erotic armada. The Dickensian schoolmasters of England were convulsed with helpless rage. The judges' hair was standing on end beneath their wigs. Black market prices in New York and London for our greenback products were soaring to fantastic heights. Tropic of Cancer is an unbelievable sewer of filth, an all-out assault on decency. Quote, "This is not a book," Miller writes in the introduction. "This is a libel, slander, defamation of character. This is not a book in the ordinary sense of the word. No, this is a prolonged insult, a gob of spit in the face of art, a kick in the pants to God, man, destiny, time, love, beauty, what you will." And there's a big, almost full-page photograph of Maurice Giraudius in Paris, 1990, with a skeleton behind him, kind of tilting his head with white hair. Turning on to page 48. Miller, though not a Jew himself, Henry Miller was not a Jew, was married to one. And he writes of a Jewess, Tania, T-A-N-I-A, in Tropic of Cancer, which is semi-autobiographical. Quote, "For her sake, I too would become a Jew. Why not? I already speak like a Jew." He then fantasizes about having sex with her as follows. Quote, "O Tania, where now is that warm cunt of yours, those fat, heavy garters, those soft, bulging thighs? There is a bone in my prick 6 inches long. I will ream out every wrinkle in your cunt, Tania, big with seed. I know how to inflame a cunt. I shoot hot bolts into you, Tania. I make your ovaries incandescent. After me, you can take on stallions, bulls, rams, drakes, St. Bernards. You can stuff toads, bats, lizards up your rectum. I will tear off a few hairs from your cunt and paste them on Boris's chin. I will bite into your clitoris and spit out 2 franc pieces. Needless to say, the ante had been raised a bit from Lawrence's much tamer work. Nationwide outrage brought Tropic of Cancer to court in over 60 different obscenity trials following its publication. And then there's a collage of newspaper headlines. U.S. court refuses to end Tropic ban. Henry Miller novel banned in New Mexico. Miller book banned. Dallas police warn stores on Tropic of Cancer. Book banned in state. Judge orders Tropic out of Florida. Jersey County banned sale of Miller book. New Brunswick. Ohio bans Tropic. Banned in Massachusetts. Miller novel Tropic of Cancer was ordered removed from newsstands in Middlesex County. Grove Press had convinced vendors to carry Tropic on the promise they would pay the court costs should it run into trouble, and they did just that, for all some 60 cases, using their massive profits from Lady Chatterley's lover. The most significant of all these cases was the infamous Chicago trial, which was the first to rule the book not obscene. What goes unmentioned in accounts of this crucial trial, Josh Lambert writes in Unclean Lips, Obscenity, Jews, and American Culture, quote, is the prominence of Jews among the advocates for Miller's novel. Haman, H-A-I-M-A-N, the plaintiff, who initiated the suit, was Jewish, and so was his lawyer, Elmer Gertz. The book's publisher, Rosset, considered himself half-Jewish. The paperback of Miller's book contained an introduction by the poet Carl Shapiro, whose most recent collection of verse was titled Poems of a Jew. Gertz called as the first expert witness to testify on behalf of the novel Richard Ellman, son of Jewish immigrants from Romania and Ukraine. The presiding judge, Samuel B. Epstein, had come to Chicago in 1911 to lead one of the nation's largest Orthodox Jewish communities. And so it went. With the stroke of a pen of one Jewish judge who just so happened to be a personal friend of Barney Rosset's father, Tropic of Cancer was cleared, against the wishes of the people of Illinois, who were represented by law enforcement officials of no less than 10 different districts. Asterisk. Lauren Glass, Counterculture Colophon, Grove Press, The Evergreen Review, and The Incorporation of the Avant-Garde, 2013, page 114. Quote, Arlington Heights, Skokie, Glencoe, Lincolnwood, Morton Grove, Niles, Des Plaines, Mount Prospect, Winnetka, and Evanston. All areas wanted to ban the book, and one Jew judge overrode them. Pretty much the story of America after 1950, say. Even the mayor, Richard Daley, had put heavy pressure on Judge Epstein not to clear the book, but it was to no avail. Quote, the day Judge Epstein handed down his decision, Rossett wrote in his autobiography, I sensed we were in the home stretch. No matter what came next, I knew Tropic of Cancer had been set free from the Philistines. Soon after, the Supreme Court concurred with the Chicago decision, officially clearing the book nationwide on June 22, 1964. This resulted in the Illinois Supreme Court's reversal of another obscenity conviction, that of Jewish comedian Lenny Bruce. Lenny Bruce and his many high-profile battles with the authorities had become a counterculture cause célèbre around this time. Allen Ginsberg even formed an emergency committee against the harassment of Lenny Bruce and circulated a petition of protest that was ultimately signed by 88 public figures, about half of whom were Jews, such as Bob Dylan, Norman Mailer, Alfred Kazin, Max Lerner, Lionel Trilling, Paul Newman, Woody Allen, Susan Sontag, Irving Kristol, Norman Podhoretz, and Irving Howe. Lenny Bruce, born Alfred Leonard Schneider in 1925, had been testing the bounds of decency and shocking audiences and authorities as early as 1957, the same year as the Roth decision, with disgusting bits such as, quote, a kid looks up at his father and he says, what's a degenerate? The father says, shut up, kid, and keep sucking. On one occasion, he came out on stage naked at a strip club where he was set to perform and urinated in a hole on stage to protest on behalf of strippers who had been complaining about getting their high heels stuck in it. His first obscenity arrest was at the Jazz Workshop in San Francisco in 1961. He was arrested for several different bits, one where he called the audience cocksuckers, and another where he kept repeating, quote, come and me, come and me, come and me, attempting to make the point that since those three words taken individually, come, in, and me, are innocuous, regarding them as obscene when strung together is somehow unreasonable. Such was the typical Lenny logic that many people with a straight face claimed was, quote, brilliant social satire. Big picture of Lenny Bruce being searched by a cop and looking all Jewy innocent. Well, the cop's got his hand in his front pocket. Lenny Bruce during one of his arrests, reads the caption. The case was brought before the same judge who presided over the Howell trial mentioned above, Clayton Horn, who instructed the jury so narrowly within the confines of Roth, they had no choice but to find Bruce not guilty. We hate this verdict, one juror told the press, but under the instructions there was nothing we could do but give the not guilty verdict. A second juror added, that's the way all of us felt, and I hope you newspaper people will report this, that we all felt the law should be tightened. Ultimately, Bruce was arrested at least 8 times for obscenity, and many other times for drugs and other offenses. Once he was even arrested for an elaborate scam in which he posed as a priest and solicited donations for a leper colony. He made quite a habit of sabotaging his own trials, though, repeatedly firing high-profile lawyers and insisting on representing himself, and then acting outrageous in and out of the courtroom. For instance, on December 16, 1964, he recited in court a bit of his about an outraged liberal who was judged unfairly by an all-black jury. For the punchline, it is revealed that the liberal, who claimed to have, quote, been since 1939 with that integration shit, was still a racist deep down. One of Lenny's main themes was that all whites are inherently racist. Quote, they gave me 20 years for raising my voice, those niggers. Judge Thurgood Marshall, who would go on to be the first black to serve in the Supreme Court, was not amused. According to Jewish lawyer Martin Garbus, who was present, Judge Marshall's head jerked up and he nearly dropped a pen from his hand. Bruce, seeing this reaction, stumbled, tried bravely to explain the joke, but could not. Then he knew he had lost the case and sat down. On another occasion, In December of 1964, with astonishingly idiotic chutzpah, Bruce invoked the alleged eternal victimhood of the Chosen Ones, exclaiming to an already exasperated courtroom, quote, "I am a Jew before this court, and I would like to set the record straight that the Jew is not remorseful." This latter case was the most important of all Bruce's trials, which, taken together, were by far the most numerous and costly in the history of American obscenity law. Asterisk, which reads, Ronald L.K. Collins, The Trials of Lenny Bruce, 2002, page 383. Quote, "The legacy of People v. Bruce is unparalleled in the history of American law. When it was over, really over, the prosecution of Lenny Bruce for misdemeanor obscenity, quote, or colon, involved at least 8 obscenity trials, 8 obscenity arrests for Bruce alone, entailed 6 trials in 4 cities, took some 4 years and some 3,500 pages of trial transcripts, required 8 state trial judges, not including the numerous judges who heard bail matters and preliminary motions, etc., involved more than a dozen state attorneys and double that number of billable hour defense lawyers, prompted legal actions by Bruce in federal courts in New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, consumed untold man-hours and amounts of public monies, involved appeals and/or petitions to state high courts, federal appellate courts, and the U.S. Supreme Court, presided over in total by 25 state and federal appellate judges, plus 9 more judges in People v. Solomon, and bankrupted Bruce, who once made nearly $200,000 a year in the early 1960s. So a huge waste of time and money of the Bruce stuff. Turning to, or flipping over to, or moving across to 53, he was convicted to 4 months in the workhouse, but granted a stay of execution. This gave him the opportunity to appeal, which he blundered through in his characteristically stubborn and self-defeating way and ultimately lost. Rather than serving the 4 months, Lenny jumped bail, leaving New York for San Francisco, where he essentially went off the deep end. His stand-up routines were reduced to him rambling and droning on, obsessing over his court battles, generally in a drugged-out stupor, and were deemed boring and unfunny by even his staunchest defenders and fans. High on a joint soaked in DMT in a hotel room in March of 1965, Bruce told his friend Eric Miller to spit in his face, and then stripped naked and jumped up on, and then fell through, a 2-story-high window, badly injuring his legs and ankles before screaming wildly and fighting with cops and ambulance attendants. 18 months later, on August 3, 1966, he fell off the toilet onto his bathroom floor. He was naked, with a needle sticking out of his arm, dead of a morphine overdose at the age of 40. Despite his early death, Bruce effectively paved the way for and is considered an influence and hero by all dirty comedians who were all too frequently Jewish that came after him, single-handedly doing for comedy what the Jew Howard Stern, who needs no elaboration, did for radio by breaking down all bounds of decency. The Jewish owner of the Café A Gogo, Howard Solomon, who had been charged along with Bruce, later had his conviction reversed on appeal, effectively exonerating Bruce posthumously. The decision cited to reverse Solomon, and by extension Bruce, was Memoirs v. Massachusetts concerning the book Fanny Hill, Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure by John Cleland. Big 2/3 page graphic of Daily Mirror. Sick jokes made audience ill. Aaron's Hotel has banned Lenny Bruce, the, quote, sick U.S. comedian. Shows him making almost a Sieg Heil-type gesture. Lenny Bruce during his performance last night. Hotel closes show. Patrons walk out. Daily Mirror in England. Jewish judge Arthur Klein of the New York Supreme Court had ruled Fanny Hill not obscene in 1963, and it was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Fanny Hill's significance laid in the fact that, unlike Howell, Lady Chatterley's Lover, and Tropic of Cancer, it was well known that it was purely pornography, without any pretense to artistic merit or redeeming social value. Cleland intentionally made the book salacious in order to make a quick buck, as he was facing debtor's prison. He never denied this motive. Justice Tom C. Clark wrote in the Supreme Court's decision of Fannie Hill that he had, quote, stomached past cases for almost 10 years without much outcry, but, quote, this book is too much even for me. Quote, memoirs is nothing more than a series of minutely and vividly described sexual episodes, unquote. After setting up the story for 10 pages, he explains, the, quote, remaining 200 pages of the book detail her initiation into various sexual experiences presented to the reader through an uninterrupted succession of descriptions by Fanny. The scenes run the gamut of possible sexual experience such as lesbianism, female masturbation, homosexuality between young boys, the destruction of a maidenhead with consequent gory descriptions, the seduction of a young virgin boy, the flagellation of male by female, and vice versa, followed by fervid sexual engagement, and other abhorrent acts, including over 24 separate bizarre descriptions of different sexual intercourses between male and female characters. End that quote, that block quote. There can be no doubt that the whole purpose of the book is to arouse the prurient interest, he continued, stating the obvious. Quote, likewise, the repetition of sexual episode after episode and the candor with which these are described renders the book patently offensive. These facts weigh heavily in any appraisal of the book's claims to, quote, redeeming social importance. Justice Clark was in the minority, though. The ultra-liberal Warren Court ultimately concurred with the Jew Arthur Klein and declared the book not obscene on March 21, 1966, with a 6-3 vote. After that, all obscenity cases on appeal at the Supreme Court were summarily reversed. Lady Chatterley's Lover, Tropic of Cancer, and Fanny Hill were all defended by the Jewish lawyer Charles Rembar, as it sounds. In his book on the trials, The End of Obscenity, Rembar wrote that the Fanny Hill decision produced the cry, pained or joyful as the case might be, the lid is off. So that basically everything in this, okay, so you're going to allow everything basically after Fanny Hill in 1966. There's a picture of Charles Rembar, The End of Obscenity, his book. The trials of Lady Chatterley, Tropic of Cancer, and Fanny Hill by the lawyer who defended them. Hook-nosed Jew in the back. With each of the books I defended, Rembar goes on to explain, most people who gave attention to the matter were against its publication. It cannot be stressed too often that it was the United States Constitution that saved these books and not the will of the people. Direct quote. And regarding the minority who agitated against the will of the people with this revisionist interpretation of the Constitution, the overrepresentation of Jews also cannot be overstressed, as I believe the above evidence shows. Two other major landmark decisions on obscenity were handed down by the Supreme Court on the same day as Fanny Hill. One was for the issue of, quote, hardcore pornography, with the infamous Jewish smut peddler Eddie Mishkin, see Part 2, as defendant. The other was on the issue of pandering, with Ralph Ginsburg, who was, believe it or not, also a Jew, as defendant. Both were affirmed, but to little effect. The new criteria for obscenity, now the Roth Memoirs test, was so broad that as long as one added a veneer of redeeming social value, be it a few quotes from Shakespeare or whatever, they could get away with just about anything. Or, as Jewish activist Leo Pfeffer gleefully put it in his book, God, Caesar, and the Constitution, all that could be hoped to be censored now was the, quote, hardest of the hardcore, unquote. And as we'll see in Part 8, even that would be unleashed by the end of the decade. The veritable floodgates, for all intents and purposes, had been opened. These decisions did not happen in a vacuum, though, of course. They ran concurrent to the shifting view on sexual permissiveness being brought about by the largely Jewish-driven sexual and cultural revolution raging throughout America at the time. This sexual and cultural revolution will be the topic of the next three parts, beginning with Part 5, where we look at the Jewish intellectual movements of psychoanalysis, sexology, and the Frankfurt School, and their pseudo-scientific justifications for sexual liberation, and Part 6, where we explore in depth the life and theories of the Jew Wilhelm Reich, who was a big one in both Kevin McDonald and particularly in E. Michael Jones, as the guy who created really the father or godfather of all the sex, pseudo sex science coming from Germany to the U.S. Anyway, that will do it for today. I want to thank you for listening to me, and I'll be back with you again real soon for more from Benjamin Garland's Merchants of Sin.